are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Bobby Seagull, a maths teacher, doctoral student, author and University Challenge contestant. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are where the name Seagull comes from, what inspired a financial trader to become a teacher, and Bobby's book, The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit. You're listening to the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I am with a teacher stroke influencer stroke celebrity and all sorts of interesting things. Good morning to Bobby Seagull. Hi Bobby, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what you do?
Yes, so good morning listeners. My name is Bobby Seagull. I'm from East Ham in the London Borough of Newham, and I'm studying for a doctorate in education, specialising in maths, as well as being a school maths teacher and trying to do a lot of work spreading the love about mathematics in the public.
And where does your surname, I've never met a Seagull before, where does that come from? I want to know.
It's a great question. So my parents are from Kerala in South India.
Yes.
And there's a Portuguese connection. The Portuguese visited places like Goa, Kerala, 1600s onwards. So actually, my dad's surname is Jose, like Jose Mourinho, the football manager, who's now come back to prominence as a Spurs manager.
Yeah, back to Spurs, yeah.
And so by rights, my surname should be Jose. I should be a Bobby Jose. But my dad read a book in the 70s called Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh, right.
By Richard Bach. A multi-million inspirational selling novella. And in the book, you know, normal seagulls, all they do is wake up, sleep, eat fish, wake up, eat fish, sleep. It's sort of a monotonous cycle.
And that's what you do in Kerala.
Yeah. But Jonathan Livingston, named after the explorer, this seagull, he said, actually, there's more to life than this. We've got wings. So you learn, you know, what it means to fly. And then he actually taught other seagulls that actually with our wings we can explore the meaning of being a seagull. So my dad loved that story so much that he thought actually he wants his kids to have the surname Seagull. So it's a totally made-up name, but it's my real name on my birth certificate from day one.
Brilliant. I've been to Kerala. It's a beautiful part of the world. And my only association prior to Seagull was I used to live in Blackpool and the football team are called the Seagulls, aren't they?
I'm a Hammers West Ham fan. I should have been a Brighton fan maybe.
We might mention football later when we talk about maths. Could you tell everyone your kind of own education story going back to your childhood in a nutshell, kind of your path in education?
Yes. So I, growing up, actually had a sort of wide range of interests. You know, obviously maths was something that I always excelled at and enjoyed at and therefore put work into. But I enjoyed my history. I enjoyed art. I enjoyed sports. So one of those students I was really encouraged and supported by my parents and teachers to develop a full range of skills and hobbies. And I went to a secondary school in East London called St. Bonaventure's, where actually it was a school where there was tough discipline in an environment where historically behaviour wasn't amazing. And our head teacher was a man that people may have heard of and have mixed views on. I loved him though. It's Sir Michael Wilshaw.
Yes.
And then I actually got a scholarship for my final 2 years to study at Eton College, which is to go from a East London council estate to wearing pinstripe tail waistcoats and playing football with Prince Harry was as far-fetched as you can get.
Yeah.
Something.
And so what happened after Eton?
So I had a gap year initially working for KPMG, the accountants, and actually I did two to three months of youth work in Scotland, in Muir House. And that perhaps has laid the seeds for my passion for education. And initially I started doing maths at Oxford for a year. And then this 4 year, another whole podcast, but I didn't end up finishing maths at Oxford. I went to Royal Holloway as a start of my second year and did maths and economics. So back then in the mid-2000s, any sort of numerate graduate, the banking world was calling. So I actually started out as a trader at a bank that some of our listeners may have heard of called Lehman Brothers. bad choice of bank.
Yeah,
I was that kind of big collapse. I did the same job for a Japanese bank as a trader called Nomura, but I moved to PwC, qualified as a chartered accountant. I'm still a chartered accountant, so I technically doing sort of accounts and books and taxes should be my cup of tea.
Right. So at what point then did teaching happen for you?
Yes, so it was a combination of two things. Actually, when I started at Lehman Brothers, I set up a social enterprise called OxFizz that supported sixth formers applying to university. So I knew actually I spent a lot of my weekends away from work supporting sixth form kids.
Yeah.
But actually, it was PwC. I took a mini sabbatical training new graduates joining the firm, so 21, 22-year-old.
Right.
And I absolutely loved the tutoring aspect. And I thought, wow, this is actually more rewarding as a person than anything I've done in the corporate world. And again, I don't really trash talk the corporate world because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the work I did, but I found this really connected me as a person. So I took time away from the corporate world. And I actually spent, I think, 6 months on a separate sabbatical, as it were, in schools. I went to every school in my borough. And actually, I ended up at one of your old schools. My cousin taught the QK Academy. So that was actually, I think, the second school I ever visited. But I sort of did a forensic investigation, visiting every school in my borough, and I was convinced I wanted to be an educator in my borough. But initially, I went to Cambridge, did my PGC, did my master's, and then eventually ended up back teaching in a state school part-time in East London.
Right, fantastic. And so you're part-time teaching and part-time kind of, I use the academic term, we're going to talk about a doctorate shortly, but micro-celebrity. So you, 2-3 days in your school at the moment?
Yes, it's changed a lot. So it's gone. It's an issue. So the reason I've had a platform to become a micro celebrity for listeners that don't know, I was on the Quiz Show University Challenge, which in Britain it's been going on since 1962. Perhaps the most sort of iconic British quiz show. I was Captain Emmanuel. We didn't win. We actually lost to Wolfson College, Cambridge in the semi-finals, actually.
I'm Wolfson.
Wolfson, yeah, boo. in my series, and myself and the captain of the opposing team, Eric Monkman, who sort of got picked up by the BBC because we had opposite personalities, but we were friends, and we had a road trip series in the BBC.
Yeah.
Have a second one coming out. Then I've had a couple of books. In fact, one book we may chat about later called The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers, all about maths, you and the world. But so that's where my sort of micro-celebrity is. So teaching has gone down from initially I did 5 days a week when I started my master's, and then when it started picking up to four, it went down to 4 days, then to two, and now what I do is I'm always a day a week in my school, and the second day I'll often work with our feeder primary schools.
Yes.
For example, next Friday I'm spending a morning working with year five girls in one of our feeder primary schools who are under comp in mathematics. So it's a really mix of being teaching my year 11.
So I know that the challenge of teaching, the workload's huge, and I also know the life of micro celebrities equally as challenging. What's your struggle and how do you balance it all?
To be honest, I'll probably say that actually my personal life is the one that takes the hit, because if you've got your work life, so normally, again, even I was teaching yesterday, and I remember the end of the day, year of 11s, a class that's sort of like a foundation grade 3-4 boundary, and I was really like enthusiastic, come on guys, you know, just, you know, got 5-6 months, you got mocks coming up in a couple of weeks, and the energy it requires to be in a class for an entire day and then to go back in the evening and then to think about the world of micro celebrity, mass influencing, it's a challenge. And I think what's sort of, there has to be something that gives way, and what has given way is I don't see my friends as much as I used to.
So what do you do to relax?
I'm a football fan.
Right.
I don't go to as many games as I used to, but I'll follow the football, I'll listen to commentary, I'll watch games on telly while I'm having my dinner. But I think when people, again, whether you're a head of department, senior leader, doing what we do, like micro-influencing, you can't, I always think it's hard to have your cake and eat it, that you're going to have to abandon certain bits. At the moment, I realize my personal and social life, perhaps I'll put it to one side while I'm sort of riding this wave of trying to really be a positive influence in maths education.
And what would be your kind of top tips for workload, not just for teachers, but maybe maths teachers, if there's a certain different aspect with maths, you know, perhaps the marking burden particularly. There's a lot of, you know, I know maths and English teachers traditionally teach a lot more content, see the kids more often, so the workload might be different. What would be your tips?
Yeah, I would say one is, again, I was a new teacher when I joined as an NQT. you know, I had the scheme of work, and we had, lots of work to get through for the year, is trying not to reinvent the wheel. There are lots of great resources out there. Ideally, search within your own department or in TES. But if you're teaching, for example, a lesson on simultaneous equations, to create a lesson from scratch on PowerPoint, whatever you use, that takes a lot of time. And again, in my NQT year, yeah, I would be in school pretty much most days till 10, 11. On Fridays, I stay till midnight to plan everything for Monday. And that's just not sustainable. And again, that's partly because I'm self-conscious, thinking I need to really deliver the best lesson to my kids. But partly, that's inefficiency. If I'm creating a set of resources on simultaneous equations, I should seek out other teachers, seek out other resources. I would say the first thing, don't reinvent the wheel. Use other resources. There have been other, there are hundreds of thousands of other teachers that created things.
Sure.
Then the second thing about marking, again, you need to give kids feedback. But what I would say is, you don't need to mark every single piece of work. The important thing about feedback is, I found is, feedback needs to be delivered during the work itself. So if kids are doing that lesson on simultaneous equations, go around in the lesson there,
Not many people know that the etymology of the word assessment means sit beside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And if every teacher actually knew the etymology of the word assessment, maybe we'd actually start to do that more rather than the marking burden. Pass that on.
Very good, Seth, and I'll write it down.
Tell me about your book, your new book.
Yes. So it's called The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers. So actually, I did a book initially with Eric Monkman, very cleverly called the Monkman and Siegel Quiz Book, and you can tell what it does. But The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers essentially is almost like a soft manifesto trying to show why maths shouldn't be a subject that's maligned in the public. Because we know that, if you go into a pub and you meet friends and you introduce each other, if you ever hear someone as a maths teacher, the reaction is going to be, oh, God, I hated maths. I couldn't do maths at school.
Yeah.
And I want to show people that, whether you're going to the gym, whether you're cooking, whether you're planning your day-to-day routine, or even dating, maths is everywhere. So it's partly autobiographical, showing my life and showing actually how you can look at things through a mathematical perspective. And it's a book that's aimed at bright kids from 8, 9 to people that are at university wanting a sort of break from hardcore maths, to people that are in the retirement age and want to sort of re-engage their brain. So it's written fairly accessibly.
And is that out now, that one, the second one?
Yes, it's out now on any good bookstores, Amazon, whatever you want to your sort of
prediction. Tell listeners, what got you interested in starting your doctorate?
So I think it's, again, when I did my PGC, so actually before I did my PGC, I remember thinking, I definitely want to go into teaching, and I've got two options. Friends have been telling me about Teach First, where you go directly into the classroom, or you've got the PGC option. And I thought, if teaching is going to be a career that's 10, 15, 20 years, rather than a couple-year program, I need to develop a real sort of pedagogical understanding of what it means to be a teacher. So I thought, I went to Cambridge, went for an interview, met the supervisors there, and I really felt like the PGC was the right route. And I did the master's as well after that. And during the master's, I was working hard. I was like a faculty lead, which is a mistake in your NQT, in my school in East London, as well as doing my master's. And I liked the master's because I love the chance of stepping away from the classroom, because obviously in the classroom, you're bogged down with, I've got to mark these things, got to set these assessments, got to input in the data, got to do the set moves with kids. And you're almost like you're on the chalk face, actually. It's not chalk face anymore, is it?
Whiteboard
face. You're doing day-to-day things and you're getting caught up. And that's obviously important. But when I went to Cambridge to do my master's work, I took a step back and thought, what's going on in the research phase? What things can I bring back and share with staff who, research can help, but they haven't got time to read? And I thought, actually, I'd love to stay connected with that sort of reflective world. And
so
that's why
your research theme is the perceptions of maths?
So mine is to do with actually looking at boys and girls and how they perceive maths differently. So again, perceptions, but again, we always hear stereotypes of boys are better at maths and girls are more creative, literary types. And I want to look into stereotypes of mathematics. And I think that sort of fed in towards my doctorate work as well.
Great. Now, I'm going to finish off with lots of quick-fire questions. So as you've been on University Challenge, you'll be used to no pauses or hesitations.
Exactly.
So before we really get into it, give me one of your maths puzzles from your first book with Monkman.
Ooh, let me actually open up See, I'm actually walking to my shelf right
let's
now.
Let's put a quiz in there for our listeners and test
okay,
the
so
methods.
I'm actually opening up a section. Hold on. Let me find a section that
fact,
is there.
While we're doing this, anyone that's listened to this, if they could reply with the correct answer to me or to Bobby, I'll personally buy a copy of your book and post it to them. How about that? So we'll really test if people are listening here.
Oh, so we've got a couple of choices. So you can have something that's like a cryptic knowledge-based puzzle, or you can have a pure numbers one, which someone would need to write.
Let's
and
go
might
for
have...
a cryptic knowledge.
Cryptic, okay, cryptic one. Okay, one is Vietnam.
Yes.
Two is Panama. Three is Burundi. Four is New Zealand.
Yeah.
And five is China. What could six be?
Ah.
I mean, I could give you a clue. I don't know if the clue might give too much away.
Right. No, let's not go with no clues. Let's leave it to listeners. So first person to reply to this podcast with that answer, if you're listening, I'll send you a copy of Bobby's new book. So one is Vietnam, two is Panama, three Burundi, four New Zealand, five is China. What would number six be, yeah?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Answers on a postcard. So here's some quick fire, Bobby. Thank you for that. What's the one thing you'd like to see change in education?
People not saying, oh, you're just a teacher.
Okay. Your biggest bugbear with maths?
People saying that only a certain kind of person can do it. The myth of the maths brain.
Okay. What are you currently working on in the classroom?
In the classroom, we're looking at ways of making sure our weakest learners are supported because they seem to be falling quite far behind compared to our top learners.
Okay. Your current task in your doctorate?
Current task is trying to make sure I really understand how to look at my work for maths anxiety to the role that I'm trying to play in changing maths stereotypes.
Right. What book are you reading for fun?
Actually reading the Simon Sings The Cold book because I'm actually later this afternoon taking part in a Radio 4 documentary with Dr. Hannah Fry about colds.
Right, fantastic. Who are West Ham playing next?
We are playing Tottenham Hotspur at the London Stadium, Jose Mourinho's first game.
Right, at their stadium?
At our stadium.
Right, prediction for your score?
Heart says 2-1 West Ham, head says 3-1 Spurs.
So it's the Saturday or Sunday game, Saturday?
It's a Saturday game.
So Saturday the 23rd of November, so check the score, West Ham v Spurs. Are you a tea or a coffee drinker?
Tea regularly, coffee on holiday.
Okay. If you weren't a teacher or a doctorate or a celebrity kind of maths teacher, what would be your dream job?
I'd be a footballer. Growing up in East London, I played against Jermaine Defoe for England International at schools level. If I had enough talent, I would have been a footballer.
Okay. Top tip for people visiting Kerala?
Go on a houseboat.
Oh, yeah, no, I've done that.
Experience. Go on a houseboat.
Fantastic. What's your biggest achievement to date you're most proud of?
Ooh, I think it's getting people actually to, in the public, when they meet me, you made me think about maths in a more positive way. Genuinely, that is it. When people come up and say, you're Bobby Seagull, maths guy, maths is all right.
Okay, top tip for people speaking on the radio for the first time?
Speak a lot slower than you think you should speak. I speak so quickly, always speak slowly.
Great. And what would be your top piece of advice for teachers who want to dabble with a bit of research? Where to start first?
I would say get involved with the Twitter community and speak to others around the world. And what I find is teachers, despite that, you know, teaching Twitter can be quite divisive, but there are lots of people willing to share their experiences. So go out there and ask people their thoughts and experiences.
Okay. What would be your theme tune of your life? What music gets you going?
Oh, my God. Theme tune of my life.
Blowing bubbles.
We'll go for that. I do like that. The Cockney Boys version. There's a separate guitar.
Oh, is there? I need to listen to that. Okay. Who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Ooh, I would say Professor Joe Bowler.
Yes, I know Joe. I'll get in touch with her. Thank you.
She's a proper maths rock star. And again, she's got views that some people really like. Some people think, oh, I'm not sure I agree. But
yeah,
I think she's
chopping cheese, yeah.
she's really passionate about maths education. It's really making a difference to young people's lives.
Great. What would you want to be your legacy?
My legacy is, I actually thought about this. So on my epitaph, on my gravestone, I want them to say, "Here lies Bobby Seagull. He made maths a little bit less icky for the population." That's it.
Fantastic. And last question, where can listeners find out more about you online, websites, things like that?
Yeah, so I would say Twitter and Instagram, I post regularly at Bobby_Seagull. You can have me on LinkedIn. I have a website, bobbyseagull.com. Not much is on it. And I do have a YouTube channel, which is aimed primarily at students, but it's there, not much content. So All those platforms.
All right, Bobby, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you. I'll see you back at Cambridge at some point for catching up on what work we haven't done. Thanks for all the work you do in the teaching community, particularly when you're on the sofa on the telly bigging up teaching. It's fantastic to see. And thank you for your time and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Perfect. It's a pleasure and an honour to be on your podcast.
Cheers, Bobby.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.